Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
My name is Alexandra Caprera. Most people call me Alex, and I am a former MFA of Simon Fraser's School of Contemporary Arts. I graduated last year, actually, and I am an interdisciplinary artist. I work primarily as a director, deviser, and also as a lighting designer. I'm originally from Toronto, Ontario, and I moved to Vancouver 3 years ago to pursue my MFA. And I've been lucky enough to work all around the world as an artist. And I primarily make work that is design-led and that focuses on interactivity between movement and design in particular. And yeah, my philosophy around what I do, I'm a queer artist and I believe in making work about queer joy and that tells these stories and that uplifts our community. And what else can I tell you? I'm a Capricorn. What else do you want to know?
Well, that's a good start. There's lots to pull from right there immediately. The thing that just stuck in my mind immediately is when you say design-led. What does that mean for me and our listeners?
So a design-led creation process basically thinks of design as a holistic part of a process, and it's often a starting point when we're creating new work. So as a deviser, when I'm making work that is design-led, often the choreography or the story actually comes from that relationship that we're building to how we interact with design on stage. In particular, that often for me means working with lighting as a dance partner on stage and using that as a vehicle to reveal new ways of looking at movement. This is also something I do a lot with video as well in design-led processes, where there's a sense of interactivity between the design that's happening on stage that makes it not less of an aesthetic thing, but more of a participant in the work itself and sort of an extension of whatever ensemble or performance that you have on stages.
Right. So instead of the lighting or other parts of the design being supplements to whatever the work is, they actually become part of it, is the idea?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. You also mentioned a focus on queer joy in your works. Why is it important to focus and highlight queer joy?
I think that queer joy is the greatest form of resistance. I think especially after the past 2 days when things are incredibly dire. It is, in my opinion as an artist, more important than ever to make space for queer joy to happen and for queer spaces to take place in the theater and dance world. And so often the work that I write about is reflective of this idea of eliciting queer joy or just imbuing my processes with queer joy for my collaborators and myself. It's a simple answer, but I think that it's the most true to my work and it's remained true for the past few years of my practice.
It's a big question. How do you come to art? I was going to ask, how do you come to dance and theater? But it seems bigger and more wide ranging than that. How does making art become part of your life?
Oh my God. I think that it is a part of your life. I think, and I hope I'm answering your question in the right way, but I think that I think to be an artist, everything you do is kind of like filtered through like your lens of like your work and the kind of ideas that you're percolating on. And I think it's impossible as artists to not move through life and respond with our work, like whether you're a writer or a dancer or a theater maker. And I think that's been true for myself in my own practice, that the art that I make and the art that, you know, I write about is so reflective of my own lived experiences and lived experiences of people close to me and responses to that. Is that kind of, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, totally.
Right. I hope I...
Yeah, I don't think there's a wrong answer to that kind of question, right?
Yeah.
Because it is very personal.
Yeah.
That does segue into talking about the work that we're here to talk about, Ultraviolets. I was reading about it, and the piece I read about it is prefaced with a quote from Bell Hooks. It says, queer not as being about who you're having sex with, that can be a dimension of it, but queer as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and that has to invent and create and find a place to speak and thrive and to live. And to me, that sounds like another way of saying what how you were just answering the question about where your work comes from. Do you find that in creating art or doing creative work that you are also sort of creating this space for yourself?
I think, yes, the space for myself, but I think with this work in particular, space for my community. I think that it's a non-singular process to make art, especially queer art, that like you have to have this collective community mindset. Especially in this work, we actually feature 10 members from the community that feature in the work as an added ensemble. And that quote in particular was so central to that, kind of encompassed how we thought about the work itself, but also I think it's really reflective and personal to me. I love bell hooks's work, and for me it's less about the idea necessarily of making art, but really like a way of being, and I guess by extension a way of making art, but this idea that we can persist past any sort of adversity and find that place to live and to be abundant in our joy and to hold each other as a community. That's kind of where that piece resonates with me and kind of in the work Ultraviolets as well.
Great. Ultraviolets is playing Thursday, November 21st and Friday, November 22nd at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media. Can you give us a brief introduction or overview of what we might expect if we go to see Ultraviolets?
Yes, absolutely. Ultraviolets has been described as a big gay greenhouse disco. It's heavily inspired by disco and queer club aesthetics, but also really inspired by plant life and how that relates to queer history. And I don't want people to go in thinking they're going to see, you know, disco in the way that we think of it with like ABBA and like Studio 58. It is unrelated to that. We've really sort of contemporized this idea of what it means to think about disco in a queer club as a space for queer becoming to take place. So this greenhouse idea and this club idea have sort of been combined to create this place that queer people can live and be authentic and, you know, step into themselves on an individual level and on a community level. You can expect lots of haze, lots of disco balls in very unlikely places, strobe lighting, loud music. It's kind of like being in a club, but you're also following this ensemble of 15 people as they sort of jump cut between these ideas of what it means to become oneself on an individual level and on a communal level. And it's really fun. It's sort of, I don't want to give it away, but it's very much kind of like being inside a club at times, and also at times quite like somber and intimate. And for me, it was about putting sapphic, in particular, sapphic intimacy on stage and queer joy on stage. And with that kind of also comes moments of queer, like, catharsis and community and anger and love. Yeah.
Great. And again, I don't want you to give it away, but on the surface, queer club culture and plant growth cycles don't live right beside each other necessarily, in my mind anyway. Mm-hmm. Can you elucidate that connection a little bit without giving the whole thing away?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very rich history, and you look at the idea of plants that have been used as symbols for queer resistance and metaphors for queer love and queer experiencing. I think of lavender and lavender menace. I think of, you know, the green flower and also pansies. And so a lot of that relationship comes from that history and how it's married to queer history. But on a choreographic level and design level, this piece was actually devised studying both plant growth cycles and the ways that plants move, and also studying iconic disco and club dance styles. So the movement is actually reflective of these two very different things, and they're all really dramaturgically combined under this idea of queer becoming. And I think, to circle back to the bell hooks quote, plants throughout history have been acting as this sort of agent of persistence regardless of what's happened in the world. There's always a way for plants to thrive and find new ways to live and to continue on despite what's happened. And that also feels true within queer history, and in particular in the persistence of queer people making spaces for this joy and this catharsis to take place. So that's kind of where those two levels intersect. So you can sort of see that visually in our movement, but also on a larger level in the way that these two ideas kind of are parallel and also sometimes intersecting. Yeah, that's what I would say. I did like, you know, a whole year's worth of like MFA research, so I'm trying to like pare it down to like, I promise it connects, but yeah.
That's great. And I can see the parallels in terms of, you know, resilience and regrowth and rebuilding between queer culture and plant growth. You've mentioned a couple times queer becoming. And I think I can piece that together in my mind, but can you give us how you would define queer becoming?
I think queer becoming, and often people think it means like the becoming of a queer person or their journey of coming out. And that's actually, I'm glad you asked this, that's actually not how we define it, especially because though I really do think this audience, the audience that we're, you know, making the show for is for fellow queer audiences. But on a larger idea, to queer a sense of becoming is to abstract your own sense of becoming oneself. And anyone can relate to the idea of growing into yourself and stepping into what is true and authentic for yourself. And so queer becoming for me is like an intentional abstraction of what that heteronormative process looks like. And that's reflected in the work, both in the way that we actually see the body and how it interacts with light. We intentionally sort of skew people's perspectives and make things intentionally look strange. And a lot of that definition comes from Sarah Ahmed's work, Queer Phenomenology. It's just a simple idea of, again, an intentional abstraction of a thing that is considered one way. And then in doing that abstraction, you're revealing new ways to look at the thing. So for us, queer becoming is a new way of examining how people become oneself. And in this work, the answers to that are through a metaphoric exploration of germination, rot, and photosynthesis, which for us is sort of this idea of being able to step into yourself, being able to sort of speak to and honor all of the hard grief and the cathartic things that come with becoming, and also this idea of becoming through a sense of community and environment.
You mentioned, you know, doing a year of MFA research and doing your MFA at SFU, which is where I am currently. What is the process of taking something that is as academic as MFA research and turning it into a piece of art for public consumption?
For me, those processes felt, it's interesting because at times they felt very separate. You have the writing side of your MFA and then the art making side of your MFA. And I built this show with five undergraduate dancers that were also in the SFU program at the time, who knew a bit about my research because it was so hands-on. I gave them some of that reading and some of that insight into the academic side. And then we really just used it as a jumping off point to devise from. So the research has kind of always been there in the periphery of the work as inspiration for me and as sort of a guiding post of the things that I wanted to accomplish as an artist and as a designer. But really, in this remount, actually, it's been kind of nice to truly separate it from the requirements of an MFA. And also, too, I think that my hope as an artist is that this work is accessible. And so it was important for me to create a work that, though inspired heavily by a bunch of this research, anybody could kind of come in and relate to it and access it. So yes, this version of the piece feels one step removed away from that research, but it, of course, is still so filled with all the many, many books I had to read and articles I had to read, which is great. But I think it's a thing that is maybe just for me to kind of have and not something that I think an audience needs to come into the work and understand it, if that makes sense.
Totally. And just touching on, you know, your hope that the work is accessible to the audience that comes, what broadly, what are your hopes for this work? What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope people take away from it?
Oh, I have so many hopes about this work. I mean, on the base level of these collaborators have brought in this community of dancers is that it creates visibility of queerness on stage and the diversity of what that looks like. And, you know, at its base level, that it elicits queer joy and that it elicits conversation and discourse about the importance of queer spaces and the importance of community. And also, I think the importance of having these conversations in both academic and contemporary spaces. I hope that people come into it and are able to relate to this idea of becoming, regardless of their own perspectives and what queer becoming might be or what this process is. But yeah, I hope that it opens up people's perspectives on both that. And on a larger note, I hope that it opens up dialogues about how we can connect with plant life and with nature. I think that so much of this work was built around like our relationship to these plants that we grew and that we studied for a year. And so the show kind of opens with this land acknowledgement that we had written about being able to listen deeply to the world around you. And that also means listening to each other, but also to our environment and our communities. So I hope that it helps people kind of lock into that idea of listening and caring deeply about each other and about this world that we're in and the plant life that's on it and the people that are on it. Yes. And I hope people come and have a great time on like a more simple level. I hope that they enjoy it. I think they will enjoy it. People have said good things. So
that's
hopefully they like it.
Always a primary consideration. The audience should have a good time, right?
I hope we'll have a good time. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, is there anything else you think myself or the audience should know about ultraviolets?
I think come see it is my final thing I will say. This piece was just, it's a huge labor of love. It's taken, you know, so many people have come forward and helped make it happen. And so I'm really excited to share it for a second time in this way, away from SFU. Yeah, that's it. That's all I'd say.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Amazing. Thank you so much as well. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Now I just see they're probably fixing some holes there. The city has to make it look like they care about our park since they're taking it away from us.
You just heard from Beth, one of the founding members of the Friends of South Memorial Park Community Group. They're petitioning for the City of Vancouver and the Committee for the FIFA World Cup 2026 to find an alternative to South Memorial Park, which is currently slated to be closed for 18 to 24 months starting in January 2025, in order to prepare the field as a practice pitch for the FIFA World Cup. This planned closure will make the park, as well as its various amenities, completely inaccessible to the surrounding public. Recently, CJSF was able to take a trip down to the park and speak with and hear the concerns of the community group, including the city's current plan to remove 15 trees from the park, 7 of which the city has claimed to be dead. However, according to an independent arborist hired by Friends of South Memorial Park, this may not be the case.
One parks board member actually said he came down here and he said, so they've told us they're cutting 15 trees, and they've told us 7 of them are dead, or 8 of them are dead. That number seems to change because some trees come back to life, I guess. So we don't know which trees they're going to kill. So that means they're cutting 7 or 8 healthy trees. So some of these trees actually are 100 years old here. And an arborist has told us that he called them specimens. He said that they're very special, some of these trees. So they've said, this guy said he came down and he looked around and said he did not see any dead trees. And did we know which trees were the dead trees that were coming down? And my response was, there are no dead trees. And to that, we've had no response, because that means they're taking down 15 healthy trees for a short-term event.
This statement came from Cindy, another member of the community group and a longtime resident of the surrounding neighborhood against the city and FIFA's current plans for South Memorial Park.
Okay, my connection goes back to when I was little and my grandparents lived in this area. This is where they immigrated to in around 1950. And we would come on Sunday and we'd have dinner and we'd come to this park. And when I was 15, we moved to this neighborhood, and I've been living here for 40 years. And this is my park. So, yeah, I go for my walks through here and I meet people. I know people at the Pollinator Garden. And it's the prettiest part of this part of town, hands down. Mm-hmm. It's the place to go when you need to just sit on a bench in the sunshine and look at some trees.
Another issue that was brought up had to do with a lack of any sort of communication or statement from the city or FIFA regarding the replacement for the current washrooms at South Memorial Park.
And so I've asked actually repeatedly now, so are we getting porta potties? We have baseball teams, we have lacrosse, we have soccer tournaments that happen. So where are these people going to go to the washroom? Because that will be blocked off. And so they've not answered us on that. There's not a lot of, from what it seems like to me, there's been a lot of planning to make this great for FIFA, and no planning whatsoever for this community. None. Not even the thought of toilets for the people who will use this park for the 2 years that this is closed.
Afterwards, Beth and Cindy spoke on the response they've gotten from the City of Vancouver as well as the FIFA Vancouver Committee.
So we're out of our park for basically 2 years for like a 4-week practice field for elite athletes.
That's basically been the response. We had another response saying, oh, we are concerned about what's happening. They've shown, you know, you judge people by their actions, not by their words, right? They have shown absolutely no care or consideration for the people of this community. None whatsoever. They have updated some of their answers on the FIFA 26 training facility page, but those answers have been in response to our questions.
Since speaking with Beth and Cindy, CJSF has put out a request for further information regarding the park's closure to the designated media contact for the FIFA World Cup 2026 in Vancouver. Unfortunately, we have received no further response, but if you want to learn more about the training sites and the various questions that have been answered, you can go to vancouverfwc26.ca/training-sites. That's vancouverfwc26.ca/training-sites. On this page, you can see certain questions that have been answered regarding the removal of certain trees, as well as the general accessibility of the park from January 2025 to fall 2026, and a short statement regarding the community impacts, which reads, "Public access will be limited during the construction and operational phases from January 2025 to fall 2026. The FIFA World Cup 26 Vancouver Host Committee recognizes the importance of Memorial South Park to the surrounding communities and the regular visitors who enjoy these sites. To minimize impact on local sports, educational, and community groups, work is underway to seek appropriate locations and alternatives to suit the needs of those impacted. This includes relocating lost field booking times at replacement facilities, and ensuring alternate locations are within the same geographical area where possible. As a result of the work done to prepare for host training sessions, these sites will be upgraded to grass sports fields with lights, drainage irrigation systems, and utilities, which will enhance the park's long-term usability. Additionally, when Memorial Park is reopened to the public, it will benefit from a resurfaced track." Once again, this is a statement from the Vancouver FIFA World Cup 2026 committee regarding the community impacts of the Memorial South Park closure. While the park's planned closure in January 2025 and the community impacts are yet to be seen, Friends of South Memorial Park plan to keep rallying against the current decisions made by the city and the Vancouver FIFA 2026 committee, as well as the current planned removal of 15 trees within the park. Once again, this has been Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. And this piece would not be possible without the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. This piece can also be found on frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And recently, CJSF was able to attend an event held by Embark Sustainability, a student-centered nonprofit based out of Simon Fraser University that works to address systemic challenges within our climate and food systems. This event, titled Penning for Palestine, focused on bridging climate equity with social justice, specifically in regards to environmental degradation within Gaza due to Israeli military attacks. As stated by the organizers for this event, this was not only just a presentation, but also a way to bring together students, activists, and community members to write letters to urge university administrators to divest from war contractors that are contributing to the ongoing occupation of the Israeli military. During the event, there were two speakers that were there for the purpose of discussing the environmental effects of this current situation. First was Ali Soriano, a local climate organizer who also serves as the communications coordinator for another student-led organization, SFU 350. Here is some of what she had to say.
In service of settler colonialism, and in the context of genocide in Palestine, how does that contribute to climate change? Well, an obvious one is the deployment of nuclear weapons, and the emissions that come from just dropping bombs is an obvious one, but I think a less obvious one is the fuel and the energy it takes to export and send these weapons of destruction.
Next to speak during this event was Parsa Ali Rezai, a former intern at the International Court of Justice who is currently working at the Center for Comparative Muslim Studies as a research assistant, as well as a researcher for Law for Palestine and Spheres of Influence as a managing editor. During his portion of the presentation, Parsa spoke on the loss of plant life and trees that are indigenous to Gaza, as well as the current forests in the area that are inhospitable and invasive to the region. Here's some of what he had to say.
They've ripped out 800,000 olive trees indigenous to that land, and they planted trees that are very prone to forest fires. Does that sound familiar? That happens here. The biggest employers of tree planting here on this settler colony, logging industry, and they destroy old growth forests, which are very well managed when it comes to forest fires, and they plant a bunch of trees very close to each other that essentially create a very hostile and invasive habitat for a natural ecosystem that exists here. And when it comes to Palestine, they do the same. They plant pine trees in a place that, you know, is hospitable for olive trees. And when forest fires happen, these dense forests, they're not good at all. And they plant them where? On the atop destroyed villages. And, you know, there's, again, another caveat I would like to explore here. Again, nothing new. Beyond Canada, down south in the U.S., one of the biggest movements towards conservationism and environmentalism was by Teddy Roosevelt, a guy that was very open about his genocidal orientation towards the indigenous peoples on Turtle Island.
Once again, this event ended by giving those who attended, students, activists, and community members, the opportunity to write letters to Simon Fraser University administrators to request that they divest from war contractors. Once again, this is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Thank you so much for tuning in, and this piece would not be possible without the support from the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
It's spawning season for salmon, and creeks across British Columbia's lower mainland are overflowing with mature salmon, making the return journey home from the oceans where they matured to the placid pools upstream where they will spawn, deposit their eggs, and start the cycle for the next generation of salmon. Many of these fish began their lives as alevin, or baby salmon, at the Mossum Creek Hatchery and Education Center in Port Moody. And this weekend at the center, a different kind of youngster will start their own journey as kids attend Homecoming, the Journey of the Salmon, to learn about the famous fish and its importance to the ecosystems it inhabits. Simona Kutnyakova is the founder of the Salmon Forest School and is organizing the hands-on learning experience for small fry. Her forest school, which approaches education from a holistic and alternative perspective, was inspired by a walk in the woods.
So every time when I need inspiration, I go to the forest. And my favorite walk is in Capilan River, which is close to the hatchery. And I went there and I was like, you know, like a light bulb. I was like, salmon. I look at the water. Water gets nutrition from salmon. Trees get nutrition from salmon. All the plants, all the animals, and us as well. Then I came home and I started like drawing like a circle that fish was in the middle and all the animals. And, you know, it was like every time like more and more and more. And I always knew like I wanted to pass all my knowledge and all my experience I learned to the little generation. That's how Salmon Forest was born.
Once the idea had taken root, Simona needed a home for the Salmon Forest.
Like, firstly, I was maybe a little bit foolish and I thought I can just do it from the park, which, you know, everyone told me that it's not that simple. And then I was like, okay, I need to think outside of box. And I literally, what I started to do was on Google Maps and finding hatcheries. Because the main point was like, okay, I would love to do forest school camp or any forest school program. And let's say just go on a field trip to hatchery, that we can have like hands-on experience. And then I found Mawson Creek, and when I opened their website, they were renting the facility, and I was like, okay, let me see.
The moment she arrived at the Mossum Creek Hatchery and Education Center, she knew it was a perfect fit.
Oh, good. Okay, so, yeah, very cool, right?
Yeah.
I know, when I saw it for the first time, I was like, oh my goodness, this is dream, you know? Honestly, I almost cried because I was like, you know, like when you have that feeling that you feel like you're home. And that really reminds me from my childhood because my dad used to work for a forest in Slovakia. And like when I would visit my dad in his job, it would be like exactly like what you see on the shelf, like